You're listening to Special Programming on YPR. I'm Jackie Yamanaka. Earlier this year, Max Baucus returned home to Montana after serving as the U.S. ambassador to China from 2014 to January 2017. Before that, he had been Montana's longest-serving U.S. senator, where he rose in seniority to chair the powerful Senate Finance Committee. The Burton K. Wheeler Center invited Baucus to reflect on his decades of public service with moderator Nicole Ray, Dean of the College of Letters and Science at Montana State University. We now join their conversation.
Well, good evening, everybody and Ambassador.
Nick.
President Cruzado reminded us that over 40 years ago, your first campaign, you walked the first congressional district. And so I'd like to kick off by just asking you, what did you learn about campaigning and about the state of Montana from that campaign, and how had things changed by the time you stopped campaigning?
How much time do we have? Well, first, I just want to thank all of you, Wheeler Center, MSU, President Cruzado, Nick, Eric, everybody. We're very happy, Mel and I, to be here. We've been away from home a bit, although representing the state home all the time. But it feels so good to finally be rooted in one spot, and not Washington, D.C., or in Beijing, be here at home. So we want you to know how happy we are to be here in Montana. I also want to introduce my wife, Mel, and I do that in part because she just such a wonderful person. But I'm reminded years ago at a program here at MSU, I've forgotten his name, a wonderful guy, he's a short fellow. He was an icon here at MSU. When he spoke, somebody praised him to the hilt, and he said, "Y'all, behind every successful man, there's a surprised wife." I don't know how surprised Mel is. I don't know how successful we are. But anyway, I loved it when I heard that years ago here. Public service has kind of been my calling. We had a psychiatrist here. Maybe he or she could kind of tell us why. I don't know. But partly, I feel very lucky in life. Great parents. I grew up on a ranch in Montana here, close to the land, able to go to schools I wanted to go to. So far, good health. I mean, I'm really lucky. And so part of me is trying to give some of that back. And in addition, I attended an overseas college program in France. At the end of the 6 months, I realized I had not learned anything. It was an experimental program. It really was not much. And so I decided, why come back home? Stay overseas. So I have a knapsack on my back, a little handbag, and I hitchhiked around the world for a year. It was during that trip, and I know kind of where it was, then Belgian Congo, it was an epiphany. It just sort of hit me. That this world's getting smaller, our natural resources are diminishing, and somehow we got to work better together if we're going to have better lives. It's just going to take a deeper joint commitment if that's going to happen. That planted a seed for a later interest in public service. I did not realize it at the time, but looking back, I know that had a lot to do with it. And then things happened and so on and so forth. I decided that I wanted to run for public office. Person I revere is Mike Mansfield. I asked his advice, and he strongly encouraged me to come back home and run. He said it takes a lot of shoe leather, it takes a lot of hard work, it takes a little bit of luck. That's all he said, really. Mike doesn't say much. But I knew what he meant, and when I decided to run for the House, the thought of using a little shoe leather appealed to me. And to walk. We Montanans, we're outdoors people. We love the outdoors. I love the outdoors. I like being out of doors. And so part of it was just being out of doors, is walking across our state, enjoying the state, seeing people, and so on and so forth. Ate like a horse, lost 12 pounds. people were, for the most part, very, very generous. Just between here and Livingston, Interstate went through the place now, but my gosh, stopped, knocked on the door, it was a Sunday family dinner. And, come on in, Max. Sat down, a great big dinner, and the woman, this lady's mother, gave me a big sack of groceries to put me on my way, and so on and so forth. So it was, what I learned, that you know, people are really good, for the most part, and you just look for the ways to kind of connect with people. On occasion, I met somebody who really gave me a hard time. It really only happened over in Lake County. Over, down the highway, and there are the missions. I come down the highway there, and holy mackerel, a couple of guys there really turned my head off. This is part of MOT, you know, Montans Against Official Discrimination. A lot of tribal tension up there in Lake County. And you know, so I talked to them, this and that. It's also interesting, one part up near Libby, walking along, one fellow, older guy, he said, well, Max, I don't know. Okay. But don't be another China Mike, referring to Mike Mansfield. And I knew what he meant. Just, okay, I appreciate it. That's what you said. I picked up a little bit of resentment in Montana against anybody in our state public servant who maybe was too close to foreign policy, mm-hmm. not enough to be in Montana, and that kind of thing. Loved it, and to be honest, I think I'm sitting here right now in part because of that walk. I was facing two primary opponents, Pat Williams and Arnold Olson. Pat was the darling of the Democratic Party. Organized labor, environmentalists. Arnold Olson had served a few years earlier. You know, Dick Shoup had defeated Arnold Olson. And so, who am I? I'm this kid from Montana, from Helena. My parents are Republicans. And how am I going to get to first base in the Democratic primary? Nobody knows me. I've got to find some way to separate myself from the others. And so I know that that helped, as walking helped establish that separation. As I walked, there was more and more interest. People walk up, meet me. And newspapers and TV stations would come out and follow me as I got closer to town. I pride myself, and I walked every step of the way. The rules I'd set up were just that. Walk every step. Now I could get in a car and go back to where I'd been. I could get a ride back to where I stopped walking. But once I got that point, I'm walking. Now, the interesting question, what about side trips? When is side not going forward? And so I had to kind of be careful about that. But I walked every step as a matter of pride. I was walking up Paradise Valley, and, you know, there are a few folks there, but not a lot, really. Well, I, you know, the goal here is to meet people, talk to people. And so, well, here's a road off on the side. Well, why not? So I just walking up this road and turned on the corner, knocked on the screen door of this house. Who should come to the door but legislator Pete Story, who represented that part of the state. Matt, come on in, Max. Good to see you and all that. So we had a cup of coffee and talked a bit. And then he said, I'll tell you what, Max, there's not many people around here. I'll tell you what I'll do for you. I'll give you a ride up the road about 20, 30 miles, and I won't tell a soul. I really thought to myself, you'll tell everybody. Not going to do that. And that happened a couple times. People, I don't know if they're friends, they're trying to tempt me to do something I should not do.
Right.
And I just said, no, I'm not going to do that. So anyway, it was wonderful.
During your 40 years or so in Congress, what were the biggest changes that you noticed on Capitol Hill? I mean, why do you think that Congress is held in such low esteem by the American public?
Yeah. Well, it has changed. When I arrived in the Senate, you know, Mike Mansfield had just left. And the Secretary of the Senate was a Montanan, Stan Kimmett. Stan Kimmett worked for Mike, then he's Secretary of the Senate. And when I arrived, Stan was wonderful. I mean, just all these stories. I mean, we had breakfast together as soon as I arrived. Nobody in the Senate dining room but for us, Stan and myself. And way over on the side was Senator Stennis, chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee from Mississippi. Stan said, "Come on, Max, let's get up and go meet the chairman." Fine. So we walk over to meet Senator Chairman John Stennis. And this was such a lesson for me. John Stennis, partly because he's a Southern gentleman, jumped out of his chair. He said, "Young man, so happy to meet you." And I thought to myself, what a gracious thing to do, to always get up when somebody comes over. I don't care who it is. You get up and show respect to that person. And and I've tried to do that always because I just think it's important to show connection, respect. But anyway, then Stan asked me to introduce me and take me back to the room. It's kind of the old one, what it was. Senator Jim Eastland, another big fancy, none of my fancy, old bowl. That's where the old bowls had bourbon late in the afternoon. And I went in there and I was felt honored. My gosh, I can sit down and have some whiskey with some of these guys. I'm just this new kid in the block, you know. And anyway, it's gone. That was starting to fade away when I arrived. But it was an opportunity for people to get together and just compare notes. "Hey, Sam, how you doing? What's your kid doing these days? You know, what about that bill we're talking about? Are you going to bring that up or not? What do you think?" You know, people started to connect with each other. And we also had back then a private senator's dining room. There's the ordinary senator's dining room. The private was just off on the side. Only senators. No spouses, no staff, nobody. And it's wonderful. I look forward to it a couple, three times a week. I go there for lunch. And by priority, just talking, comparing notes and this and that. And it's really good. That's gone now. Nobody goes anymore. Why? Because now, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, each party has its political luncheons. Plotting strategy, how they're going to defeat those awful people down the hall, both ways. And we're fundraising, out fundraising. The biggest change, I think, is the additional money in politics today. When I first ran in 78, the Senate, I raised and spent $600,000. Every 6 years, that doubled. One, two, two, four, four, eight. And all the milk could help the last race. $24 million raised and spent. It's wrong. It's nuts. But you have to do it. You have to raise it because that's the system. Otherwise, it's a unilateral disarmament. And it's very pernicious. It takes away our time. I found, too, that with each succeeding race, I had less control over my campaign. Outsiders had more control with all the money and the ads and whatnot. It's a problem. Clearly, it's Citizens United, Supreme Court, et cetera. What's it going to take to change it? Change the Supreme Court. Hard to amend the Constitution. But it may be like Watergate. There's a big change in Watergate because there's too much money being spent. That's what caused, I think, break in, cover up, and all, in part because they had so much money comparatively back then. I tend to think that we may have to face another crisis where there's so much money that it's spent fraudulently. It just in a way that's going to finally wake people up and But that's a big change. I can go on forever. Other major changes are just advances in technologies. Senate televised. Senators, therefore, would spend a little more time talking to their constituents, not to senators. Speeches on the Senate floor, not related. Speeches to persuade a colleague to do this or do that. Those days are pretty much gone. So it's, and social networking, oh gosh, it's just terrible. It's just, and also the media, it's so bad that TV studios, newspapers, in order to keep paying attention to the bottom line, have to run more ads, have a smaller news hole, pay less to reporters, fewer reporters. Major national journalists hate it because they're about 4 or 5 news cycles a day. They have no time to get the depth. They want to do what's right, most of them, and but on a time. It's just terrible. In addition, people tend to watch either Fox News or CNN. It's just so much easier to watch somebody you tend to agree with. I remember a long time ago, I was over at the Baxter Rotary Luncheon, and somebody asked me, well, Max, what newspaper columnists do you read? Where do you get good information? And my answer was, well, depends whether you want to reinforce your bias or whether you want to learn something. And it's just, there's insufficient critical thinking today. People just take what they see and don't question it, examine it, decide for themselves, is this right or not right?
I'm sure we have some MSU students out there, so would you still encourage our students to think about a career in public service?
Absolutely, absolutely. I loved it. I have no regrets. I think the most noble human endeavor is service. Service to church, to synagogue, to community, to friends, to family. It's service. And or public service. In fact, I'm trying to put together, I'm sorry, Waddad, it's over the other campus. An institute over there. One of my goals is to encourage younger people to get public service. I went down to Monterey, California, to talk to Leon Panetta. He's got the Panetta Institute down there. And they're doing something I'd like to put together in Montana, statewide. They invite, you know, inspirational speakers like Colin Powell and others, and then give them classes, send them back afterwards to Washington, work in various California congressional offices for 3 months, and with classes and this and that, is getting them involved in public service. I think it's so important because it's, I think, fewer people today are interested in public service probably than maybe was the case years ago.
Let's go to the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue. Your junior congressional career, or your congressional career spans 7
right.
Administrations
right.
From, I think, Ford to Obama. Which one of those presidents impressed you most?
You know, they're all different. And they impressed in different ways. I think it struck me. I just arrived in the House. President Ford invited new House members. This is a Watergate class of 74 up to them for breakfast. And it's really interesting. He talked about something. Then he had Henry Kissinger kind of explain what was going on. Ford was very good. Ford was he's a decent guy. Liked him. Jimmy Carter is very different. Jimmy Carter is an engineer first, second and third. I'll stop there. So during the Melez period, Jimmy Carter's presidency, you know, I called up the White House and said, Mr. President, I'd like to come up to Camp David. He's having all his folks up to Camp David to kind of figure out how to deal with Melez. Inflation was, well, interest rates were 20%. I can remember talking to Paul Volcker, who's chairman of the Fed, just giving, I was angry. We're a small business state. We can't afford 20% interest rates in Montana. You know, the big boys, big banks in other states, we just can't. You got to do something about that. And then he just looked at me. But anyway, during that Melez period, I called up the president. I said, you know, I had to come up to Camp David, give you my two bits. And he says, okay, fine. And then one day, Sunday morning, phone rang. It was the president. Said, Max, can you come up to the White House? And I'll see you between Sunday school and church. I know you want to see me. Great. I said, what time? He gave me the time. I like to run. I got time to go for a little run. I was out running. Holy mackerel. He gave me the wrong time. So I turned around and as fast as I could, and I didn't have time to shower, and I broke all the speed limits, and I got over to the White House. And just in time, and he had his prayer book. We were going off to church. Got in the limousine, off to the First Baptist Church. Well, anyway, then we went to his church, and then and he knew all the answers at the Sunday school. But he tried not to raise his hand too much. He said, okay, Master, let's go have... He got up, and all the Secret Service got up, off we go in the room. Well, I didn't have much to say, really, but except that all I said, which is very basic, Mr. President, you are the president. You're the leader of our country. People want to look up to you. They want to look up to you as president and to you personally. You are president. And just... lead, say it, to think, connect with people, but just lead it. I just looked at me, and that was that. And so, anyway. Reagan is really interesting. I liked Ronald Reagan a lot, frankly. A couple times, they'd go up to the White House. He was the first one to use cue cards. So you're sitting, he's in the cabinet room there, and all the senators around the table. And he didn't really know his stuff that much. So he'll pick up these cards and just read from his cue cards. And you know, that's fine. But Democratic senators spoke very disparagingly about that. They were outraged. How could the President of the United States not know enough about his subject and have to read from cue cards? They're very superior Democratic senators. It just, you know, a lot of some hubris there. I mean, come on. But the thing is, almost every other president followed that procedure. George Bush, H. Bush did. George W. Bush did. Clinton did not. Obama did not. Reagan used cue cards. He was a great storyteller. One time we're up there. Really, the big question was NAFTA. And I was the most junior guy in the room, so it came around to me at the end of the table. And I said, I started out by saying something pretty lame, like, well, Mr. President, as you know, Montana borders Canada. You know, NAFTA's right. And he said, oh, Montana, he said. My favorite film was Cattle Queen of Montana. And he started talking about the film. He didn't care anybody. He didn't care two hoots about NAFTA. That's a bit of an exaggeration, not too much of an exaggeration. And so he talked about trying to get his horse across the stream. And he's kicking his horse went across the stream. And how a movie technician actually had a bean shooter, you know, the well-placed bean, he finally got his horse across the stream. And his chief of staff, I think, was Don Ring at the time, trying to get him back on message here. He didn't care about that. And so often he'd tell stories, and they were great stories about this and that. And he's a communicator. I mean, he's good. And I like him, too, because he had a vision. He wanted to, it was during the Cold War. It's much easier to be president during the Cold War because it's them against us. When the Berlin Wall fell, I happened to be in Rio de Janeiro during the Earth Summit. And man, oh man, I could just feel it. The world cataclysmically changed. Tectonic plates are all shifting. Because countries and companies didn't have to care at all anymore under which national security umbrella they were under. Either the United States or this former Soviet Union. Didn't have to care. It's irrelevant. I also appreciate him because he was a president, last president to get major tax reform passed. My view is, it's very difficult to get major tax reform passed unless the president spends a lot of capital and invested in it. He was. Subsequent presidents have not. Then we had the other Bushes. They're nice. George H. Bush, nicest guy in the world. But then when he speak publicly or semi-publicly, a curtain fell. TV was not kind to him. And he was not, it was hard for him just to talk to the country, to the public. He wasn't the same, uptight. But personally, the nicest guy in the world. He just loved the guy. George W., he's kind of a jock. We were sitting together once, White House. He's president sitting here, and I'm sitting here. Before the meeting got started, I used to run a lot. I used to run a lot of marathons. And somebody said, "Oh, Max, you run a lot of marathons. What's your best time?" So I mentioned my best time. Good Lord. President, why? He was so stunned and so impressed that we bonded as jocks. Not intellectually, not geographically. This is jocks. And he always called me Maxie after that. Hey, Maxie. Hey, Maxie. Clinton's one of them. Clinton's really smart. Really smart. And he was in lots of ways. One small story. It's my job was really represent Montana as best I possibly could. There was an issue. Some of the budget cutters came up with the idea to cut out these rural electric. I don't think it's forget what it was. It's the power administrators, just to get rid of them all around the country. Well, a lot of us in eastern Montana especially just were outraged, as true in other parts of the country. So I put together an effort to meet the president, President Clinton, 20, 30 members of the Senate, and why this is a bad idea. We met. I spoke last because I organized the meeting. And I said, it's bad on policy, it's bad on politics. Don't do it. He looked across the table at Al Gore. It's Al Gore's idea. And he said, "Al, why are we doing this?" And Al said something lamely, and I tell you, Bill Clinton, you could tell, was very upset. He just, meeting's over. Enough of that. That was the end of that. Didn't hear another word. So he listened. He really did. Another time I spoke to him once is on China. And I did, as Wadad said, worked hard to help China get WTO, and there's tons of stories there. Anyway, he looked at me and said, "What do we do about China?" I said, "We have to respect China. China's a country, we're a country. China has interests, we have interests. It's mutual self-respect, but we have to respect China." And he looked at me and didn't follow up much, and he gave me this stare. And I do think it had some effect on Clinton being a little more positive toward China and working in WTO and PNTR for China. That was kind of tough, that period. Small story there. Zhu Rongji was the premier of China at the time. Brilliant man. I admire him as much as anybody in the world. And anyway, I said to him, I will support you and WTO for China if you take Pacific Northwest wheat. Because China was not taking Pacific Northwest wheat. They'd take Canadian wheat, but not Pacific Northwest, not American wheat. He said, "Okay, that's a deal." I said, I had to remind him a couple times afterwards. Said, "That's a deal. A deal's a deal." Very long story, very short. I was over afterwards and trying to help promote Pacific Northwest wheat in China. Met with one big minister and said, "Oh no, we didn't agree to that." I kept quiet. Another meeting, another minister. "We didn't agree to that." I kept quiet. Third meeting. They again said, a vice minister, agriculture, "No, we didn't agree to that." I let him have it, both barrels. I said, "You will regret the day you did not honor this agreement. I urge you to reconsider, because you will rue the day that you reneged on this agreement." He just sat there. Final meeting with Premier Zhu. 4:30, 5 o'clock, 5:30. Finally, we got the meeting. I turned and I said, he looked at me and said, "Yep, that was the deal." It's sort of a lesson here, my judgment. if you stand up to anybody, including the Chinese, and work for what you know is right, you've got to stick with it. When I was over in China, I developed what I call my three Ps. You've got to be patient, positive, and persistent. You've got to stick with it. And but anyway, Clinton was good, and then after Obama, President Obama, he really cared about, as you know, health care. That was his major issue, domestic issue. And we worked really hard in health care. That's a whole other story, too. But I like to work with him. Very smart. Here's a little fill-up here. When I was chairman of the committee, he came in to see me. He said, Max, when he's a senator, I want to be on your committee, the Senate Finance Committee. And I said to Barack, well, Barack, I already have one senator on my committee who wants to be president. I don't need two. It's John Kerry. And he said, well, that's fair. You know, if I run for president, then I don't want to be on your committee. But if I don't, I'd like to. So we talked about that. Should he not run for president? It was kind of a long conversation. The options were either run or to then become governor of Illinois, then run as governor. Anyway, my advice was you got to strike when the iron's hot. That brass ring only comes around once, mostly. So he said, yeah, I know. But I promised Michelle that if I do run, I will be a good family person. I won't, I'll be around. Because that's important to me. It's important to Michelle, the kids, and so forth. Well, a year or two later, finally passed the health care bill, House and Senate. We're at the White House, sitting across from the table. House members over here, I'm sitting across. Other senators over here. I'm representing the Senate. Nancy Pelosi is representing the House. And about 7 o'clock, no, earlier, it's 5 o'clock, 5:30, President Obama stood up and said, well, got to go. What do you mean got to go? We haven't finished here. He said, no, Sasha is in a play tonight, and I'm going to go to the play. So I really respected that. I mean, he's doing what he said he was going to do. And so they're all, they're wonderful men.
Stay with the Affordable Care Act. You, as chair of Senate Finance, you were one of the major architects of that. How do you think that it's worked out in practice, and what are your thoughts on the future direction of health care in the U.S.?
Yeah, well, again, long, long stories, and I'll try to keep it shorter. I really threw myself into it because we did not have a health care system in America. Basically, everybody's doing his own thing. Doctors, hospitals, pharmaceuticals, medical equipment manufacturers, it just a free-for-all. Providing health care but making a buck. It was a free-for-all. Other countries had their systems. We didn't. We had to. And other countries pay much less per capita health care than we, 3 times less, and their outcomes are better than ours. We had to do something. So I worked really hard on this. In 15 months, it was wonderful. Republicans, Democrats working together. Came out with our white paper in November of 2018. All other committees passed legislation based on that white paper. There's a healthcare economist named Uwe Reinhardt from Princeton. He testified before our committee once, and he held it up. He says, this is the best I've seen. I'm using it for my classes. And we're really proud of it. The main goals were coverage, get more people health insurance, and we succeeded, 20 million more. Another goal was to change the way the government reimburses providers, because it's based too much on procedures, on volume, not enough on outcomes. And the third was to cut costs. Well, we did well on number one, so-so on number two, and not very well on number three. Cutting to the quick here, what has to be done? Why do we spend so much more as Americans on health care than other countries? It's pretty simple, frankly. One is other countries have single-payer systems. And under single-payer, underpay, they have various variations. The government pays providers. In the United States, we don't, obviously. backing up a little bit, when I put the committee together, we worked on healthcare, my goals were, okay, everything's on the table. Everything. All America's involved. Either as consumers of healthcare or as payers of healthcare. We're all together as Americans. This is an all-American solution here. And if anybody wants to take anything off the table, first of all, nothing's off the table. Although I did take one thing off the table, single pay. Because I felt at that time this country could not pass a single-payer system. We're going to get there, but not at that time. I came up with what I called, we have to have a uniquely American solution. Combination of single pay and go west, young man, free market, United States. And that's what we did. So I think we should very seriously consider a single-payer system. I think number two, we should have something that's called negotiated price for Medicare drugs. We don't negotiate price. And as a consequence, everybody in this room, you're all subsidizing drug costs in other countries. Because other countries negotiate price. Other countries, Great Britain, France, whatever, goes to pharmaceuticals, say, okay, we're only going to pay you this. We're not going to pay you anymore. And we're the only payer, so our price counts. And it's not so in America. The pharmaceuticals just fight it tooth and nail. They hate it. When we put the bill together to get coverage and all these other things, it cost $1 trillion over 10 years. But we found $1 trillion. It was all paid for. The providers coughed it up. Hospitals, pharmaceuticals, they all did. Why? Because with additional coverage, be more patients, they can make it up. And that's what we did. Right now, President Trump and the Republicans are trying to undermine what we did. And so the single payer, the individual market starts to collapse. I think it's tragic. But I think we have to think about single pay, negotiated price. And also, this is, our administrative costs are much higher than other countries. Why are our administrative costs much higher? Look at it. All the insurance, variations of insurance, private, public, and so forth. And I remember with Hillary Care, went up to Havre. Havre Hospital has one floor dedicated to claims processing. Another floor is healthcare. Well, I want to check out the Canadian system. So I went up to Edmonton. And a huge big hospital, one little room for claims processing. Why? Because in Canada, Alberta, you just show that you're a Canadian resident. You don't have to show you're a citizen, that you're a resident. And you get taken care of if it's emergency care. If it's discretionary, you got to stand in line. Anyway, I think we should have hearings on single pay. Look into it it's going to take a year, two or three. We're getting there. It's going to happen.
North Korea. As ambassador to China, you obviously were in the front line of dealing with the whole issue of North Korea and nuclear weapons. And I think we'd be really interested to hear your thoughts on, we seem to be between a rock and a hard place on this. I mean, what is the way forward here? Is there a way forward with this regime? And what, you know, should be the U.S., how should the U.S. and China work on this issue?
Yeah. Well, I think fundamentally, we as Americans have to realize that the big boy on the block is China. China's not going anywhere. China's second largest economy in the world, we're the largest, we all know. 10, 15, 20 years, their economy will exceed that of ours. With the annual growth rate of close to 7%, it doubles every 10 years. Their military spending doubles every 5 years. There, we got to work with China. My view is, generally, the better we, as Americans, the Chinese, mutually handle that relationship in a solid way, the more likely that the standard of living of our kids and our grandkids will be better in the world than if we don't. It's part of the old Thucydides trap question. Before going over there, I read Kissinger's book on China. He talks about, Rising Powers, Deluge Powers. It's a great book. I highly recommend it. It talks a lot about the Chinese approaches to problems. And it's like Wei Qi and Go and the board games and salami slicing and long-term vision, strategic, etc. It's really true. And the problem in North Korea, as you all know, is, oh gosh, there's an awful lot of history of China and North Korea. In the Korean War, you know, Mao didn't think we'd get too involved, but when Kim Jong's grandfather, Kim, came down in South Korea, South Korea pushed back, and so Mao sent over a million Chinese to North Korea to push in the Korean Peninsula to pull us down, because there's a very deep involvement Chinese do in the peninsula. And they didn't think we were going to come, but we did. And it's important to remember that we Americans bombed the bejeebies out of North Korea. So it's just a great propaganda tool. Those Americans, look what they did to us. They've got those ships out there on shore. Look, they want to contain us and bomb us. And he controls all the media. And we're, in a certain sense, playing into all this. Now, from the Chinese perspective, Kim Jong-un, from the Chinese perspective, maybe a lot of people know that, but I think it's good to remind us. We're back up. When I would talk to Koreans, Chinese, often about Kim Jong-un. And the main guy is a guy named Wu Dawei. He's their main negotiator and has been for 20 years. And it's like talking to a brick wall, nothing. And I'm very candid, kind of embarrassed. Whenever we, with President Obama, Secretary Kerry, others would come over and talk to the Chinese about various issues, including this, it was not very solid. It was a little superficial, like checking the box. Not thought through, from my perspective. And when Trump became president, a little more of the same. Even more difficult because Trump had different messages, like hot and cold and just and so forth. And so from the Chinese perspective, the Chinese they have a neuralgic obsession with security and stability and legitimacy, the party. And they will do almost anything to maintain their legitimacy as the party. And that means stability. And that's economic and political stability. And they're very concerned if there's instability on the peninsula, that tons of refugees that come over into China cause havoc. But more important, with an unstable peninsula, who knows what might happen? Who knows who might succeed Kim? Probably the Americans will join with South Koreans and they'll be in control of the peninsula. China will not stand idly by if the peninsula becomes unstable. Korea's next door, and they don't want an unfavorable country next door. They want a favorable country next door. So they want stability. They'd rather currently deal with this fella, Kim Jong-un, who they don't like at all, and take the risk that this could be managed. So they don't have to do what they could do, which is cut off oil supply. And they could do a lot more if they really wanted to. But they don't want to because they want to keep what they have right now power. So what do we do? My judgment is we need carrots as well as sticks. What's that book, Fulgham, that wrote this book about everything I need to know I learned in kindergarten? I mean, you got to treat people with respect if you want to get anywhere. And it's both. It's you got to push. You got to with carrots and sticks and so forth. So what could we do? Here's my thought. That we say, okay, China, you don't like this young boy Kim over there. He's causing all these problems. If I'm China, I'm thinking, okay, I want to know what the end game here is. End game is on the peninsula, who's in charge, who's not. End game is, what about you Americans, what do you do in the South China Sea? End game is, you Americans, what about those forces you got, those ships that you got there off the Korean Peninsula? There can be a deal. And then China might do what it needs to do and force Kim to the negotiating table. What Kim really cares about is legitimacy, no regime change. He's very cleverly, smartly positioned himself to get all this attention. And my judgment is that there's going to come a time when he's thinking, okay, I've got maximum amount of power right now, so maybe we can start doing the deals. So long as, this is the tough part for him, I'm still the man. I still have almost as much power as I had before. Because you know, he watched what happened to Saddam Hussein. He watched what happened to Gaddafi. They made a big mistake, according to him. So probably there'll be some kind of a freeze. He'll still have something so he could keep some leverage of some kind. The road through a Kim solution is through China. I've suggested this to a couple of people. It's getting a little traction. I'm being very presumptuous now and thinking it's an approach that really makes sense. But it's the best I can come up with, and I do think it will. Because look, in the long run, we've got to work with China. And they want to work with us. We're joined together at the hip economically. There's not going to be a trade war. They don't want a trade war. We don't want a trade war. That's stupid to suggest there might be a trade war. It's not going to happen. But we've got a lot of subjects here. Once we develop more trust with China, then we can start working out some of this. We won't always agree. We're going to have to stand up for what we believe in and say, okay, China can't go any farther. But there has to be a much better dialogue / understanding of what we can do. It's going to take immense shuttle diplomacy. It's going to take immense back and forth and different people, different levels to get to know each other better. It takes time. It takes time. And it is going to be so hard because our system of government is based on process and negotiation and so forth. Theirs is more in results. This is what we want. But we got to live with each other. And I think China will want to reach some accommodation with us.
I'm a political parties guy in my teaching, and so I have to ask you this one. You've been, you were renowned as a moderate Democrat during your congressional career, and you had a phenomenally successful electoral record in a conservative state. So I think I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on the future direction of the Democratic Party and where they should be going.
Some hardcore Democrats would fault me for not being sufficiently partisan. But you are who you are. You can only do what you think is right and best. I remember Mike Mansfield once saying, I am who I am. That really struck me. And after I got elected in his house, Mike said to me, now, Max, remember, you represent Republicans as well as Democrats. He didn't have to tell me that. I knew that. Because I represent all of Montana. I'm a Montanan. Montana's first, the people are first, and the party is second. And sure, I've got my values. I talked about single pay just now and labor rights and laws and so forth, but you got to find results. And I just like to get results which are, right and fair and reasonable and so forth. It's not quite on point exactly, but my view has been that if you really work hard and meet as people as much as you can and explain to them, to people, town meetings, whatever, why you're listening to other person's point of view, but if they explain why you're doing what you're doing. And I think 70% will say, okay, I may not totally agree, but at least he's listening to me. At least he's kind of thought about some of the other considerations, and that's okay. He's back there and that kind of thing. Forget the 15% in the far right and the 15% in the far left. They're lost anyway. But it's just, it's try to do that. Second, you know, I really, this sounds corny, but it's true. I really care about Montana and fighting for Montana. When I got back there, I realized, holy mackerel, we got a problem. You know, rural states kind of get lost out when money's divided up and with its highway. I mean, it's a separate story. But rural health care, and you name it. And I put together something called the Rural Healthcare Caucus for rural states. We put the thing called medical assistive facilities, and a special way to get hospital payments for small Montana hospitals, et cetera. And the highway bill. I spent a lot of time bringing highway dollars to Montana. 19th Avenue. I did that. I made a lot of people wealthy. The Belgrade Interchange, Helen Interchanges, Shiloh, you name them. Those were the days when we had earmarks and you could do it. I think it's wrong that we got rid of earmarks. Why? Because earmarks, most of them, 90%, they're good, not wasted. And they're the glue to help members of Congress work together and this and on and so forth. Now if they're gone, it's a little antiseptic. We were too politically correct. We got bamboozled by the press. And because they're terrible. Press, oh, earmarks. But anyway, and we're a highway state, probably more than any other state. And the vernacular, we're a don't eat state. We get a lot more money than we spend highway gasoline tax. And so I think prior, it helped that I got worked really hard for the state. My dad mentioned agriculture. I worked hard to make sure we had good farm bills for Montana, and always, you know, support payments and all that. And then I really cared a lot about conservation in our state. I worked very hard for open space of the legacy of, you know, in northern Montana, 300,000 acres. And I did that in North Fork, Eastern Front, stopped the Crown Butte down in Yellowstone Park. Bill Clinton asked me once, too, Max, he's back here. What do you think about that, Max? I said, bad idea. I didn't have to say any more. That's the end of it. So I'm just working hard. And I mean it. I mean, really care. I'm a bit of a workaholic at times. I only care. And being so available to people, walking in the lion's den. I love walking into the lion's den. It's a challenge. And the whole card is, Max, you know, you learn something, but it's, you know, basically, and they might learn something too. The most favorite, one of my favorites, and I'll try to keep this short, I loved it. I called it work days. And it went almost one day a month, I'd show up 8 o'clock in the morning, some job in Montana, with my sack lunch, work all day long. Didn't want to watch, but it worked. Wait tables, sawmills, operating equipment, and the Stillwater mine. They worked jack drills in the Stillwater mine, so on and so forth. Once I was riding upon shotgun with Zip Beverage outside of Missoula. We were all around delivering kegs of beer. Gosh, the depot over there in Missoula. First big keg. Holy man. I about went down the basement with this keg. They're heavy. And pop. The taverns and so forth. Anyway, at the end of the day, is the airport bar, this big old guy, I said, you know, I want to walk over and shake hands with this guy. I'm like, oh, I know who you are. anyway, well, just stand up. I could, remember that movie, Dr. Strangelove? That arm down, is it gonna, you know, it's going to pop up. I kept wondering, is he going to shake my hand or not? Raging battle going inside of him. Is he going to shake my hand or not? Finally, he stood up. He's a big guy. And he looked at me. This is after I voted for the Brady Bill and for the so-called Feinstein ban on the manufacture of new assault rifles. And by the way, That was a big deal. I was the most popular public servant in the state before then. Mark Roscoe and I just went like that. And that's one of the subjects. And anyway, he says, this guy, the big guy, says, are you going to come tonight and tell us why you made them gun votes? Well, who are you? We're the Association to Protect the Second Amendment. How many? About 200, 300. What time? 6:30. I already had an appointment then, but I wanted to go. My office, don't go. First thing we'll do. And I had a TV interview at 6 o'clock. First question, are you going to go to this meeting? I knew it. They're going to leak it. Well, I decided I was going to go, but I wanted to get there late and not be set up. And I'm afraid if I go on time, they'll have all the TV cameras there, just give me the Dickens in front of the TV cameras, and that just is not going to accomplish anything. I arrived 40 minutes late. Sure enough, TV van's driving away. I was really lucky. And also lucky, I was working for Zip Beverage, so I had my jeans and my black Budweiser shirt on. I want surprise and keep my cool. I said, Max, whatever you do, you got to keep your calm. You're not going to let anything happen to get under your skin here. Walked up and cut to the quick here. I said, just let me speak 5 minutes, uninterrupted. Just let me speak 5 minutes. And then let her rip. They let me speak 5 minutes. I said, well, sure enough, all hell broke loose. The big actor, at the end of the room, some great big guy, always big guy. He stood up and said, un-Senator Baucus, that is your title. You're an un-Senator. You'll never be a senator again. You violated your oath of office, the Montana Constitution, the United States Constitution. And when he finished, something occurred to me. He said, well, sir, I hear you. That's a position you hold fervently. It's heartfelt, sincerely felt, and I respect that. But I urge you to listen to what I said and give some thought to what I just said. You could feel the tension in the room fall. Something happened. Then pretty soon evolved to a political science seminar. Do you support the 10th Amendment of the Constitution? Of course I support the 10th Amendment of the Constitution. Support the 2nd Amendment, 10th Amendment, all. And well, why do we need a federal government? We states can do it. 10th Amendment, that's enough. And so we talked about that a while. Supremacy clause and all so forth. And I said, we could decide right here and now which parts of the Constitution we're going to support, or are we going to support the entire Constitution? Well, that's a whole new concept, because these are fervent constitutionalists. And at the end of the hour and a half, I couldn't believe it. I got a standing ovation. Now, not the most exuberant in the world. But they got up. And I kept asking myself, what happened here? And I think part of it is just respect. I showed up. I was there and so forth. But that was, so I just think it's so important, whatever you do in life, whether it's public service, whatever, just show up, be there. 80% of life is showing up. Just being there. And it's fun.
You've been listening to former U.S. Ambassador to China and U.S. Senator Max Baucus speaking at a lecture series sponsored by the Burton K. Wheeler Center on September 7th, 2017. This YPR production was made possible with help from the Wheeler Center, MSU, and Montana PBS.